Mr.
Ken Emmy. Hello, WGN listening audience.
Live from the biggest small town in America, it's the Saturday Night Special with Amy Goode.
WGN. Hello, it's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special with a brand new opening theme music there, courtesy esteemed producer Tom Hush. I love it. Thank you, Tom. Well, it is the first episode of the Saturday Night Special in 2018, and so to be sure, we are going to be talking about how to make the year ahead a great one. In particular, we're going to be talking about body and mind health and wellness. You know, and certainly we throw around phrases like, oh, this year it's going to be different, and new year, new me, and I'll make all kind of grandiose plans, and we feel so sure this year is going to be different, and this year we're going to do it right. But do we stick to those large promises? Well, according to U.S. News and World Report, 80% of our very hopeful and earnestly made plans for self-improvement will fail before February, and only 8% of us will achieve our New Year's resolutions at all by this time next year. Ugh, that's not very uplifting data, is it? So how can we change the odds and set ourselves up to beat them? Well, nothing ever will guarantee our success with absolutely anything on earth, of course. But our guests tonight are going to help us try to put the odds a little more in our favor. We're going to talk with Dr. Lisa Kaplan about how to keep ourselves motivated and set very meaningful goals. We're going to talk with yogini and entrepreneur Amber Carnes of Body Positive Yoga about rethinking how we think about and talk about our bodies, with social scientist Dr. Judith Tedley Moskowitz about thinking positively, especially in very stressful times. And from the Field Museum, Amy Davis will join us to talk about expanding our horizons and right there in our own minds with institutions right here in our city. That's all coming up tonight on the Saturday Night Special. We'll be right back to get this conversation underway on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. And tonight we are talking all about wellness, both mind and body. And of course, it's a good time of year to talk about that because we're all thinking about those resolutions. And I think a lot of times we think about resolutions and we get really ambitious and out the door they go and then they fall flat. So we are joined tonight by a bunch of very smart people that will help us make the best of the year, particularly, as I said, around wellness. We're joined first by Lisa Kaplan, who is a regular guest on this show. We know her, we love her, and she's one of the people we call anytime we ask ourselves what makes people act that way. And you can find out more about her at lisakaplan.com. She is a psychologist and a life coach. Thank you so much for joining us tonight, Lisa. Welcome back to the program.
Great. Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Well, Happy New Year to you. And
you too.
Thank you. When we think about, you know, I think it's almost irresistible, you know, to the idea of making resolutions, because it does feel like this fresh start. It's a new year. We don't know what lies ahead. And it is kind of romantic and exciting to think about having this whole year ahead. But it's almost, I don't know, it almost feels a bit cliche to make all these plans, because people, I think it's the norm that we don't hit the mark. We, you know, this time next year, I think it's almost expected that we won't have necessarily met our resolutions per se, but particularly when we're talking about body and mind and our emotional health, you know, where do we start that conversation about New Year's resolutions or just making any kind of meaningful change in a way that is impactful, in a way that really matters and will sink deeply into us?
Well, there's two things that really get in people's way. And by the way, most people do not achieve their New Year's resolutions, so you're right on target. The numbers are not good at all. The first is, why do you want to make this change? A lot of people, you know, I want to lose weight, or I want to exercise more, or be healthy in some way. But there's not a deep down reason for it. It's often, well, for my sister's wedding, or, you know, this big event here, or I'm going to look good in a picture. But it's not really true to, like, attached to their heart, for lack of a better word, or better phrasing. So one is to really figure out, why do I want this and why is this so important to me? So that we're attached to the work that needs to be done in order to get there. But the second piece that I think a lot of people make the mistake of saying, okay, I am going to lose 50 pounds this year, but with no real specific plan of how they're going to do that, no first step, how are you going to get that done? Well, I'm just going to eat less and I'm going to exercise more. How? If we don't really have this, you know, day-to-day specific plan, it's not going to happen. So we'll hold on to it for a day or two, or, you know, supposedly by January 9th, most people have already given up on their resolutions. So we hold on to it for a few days and then it's done because we don't have a day-to-day long-term plan of how we're going to actually accomplish it.
That is a very good point. I've heard that before, that it's January 9th. I think it's a holiday at some point.
It's like, it's the, exactly.
Like National Give Up Your Resolutions Day, which is sad that, you know, to start the year feeling so disappointed or feeling, you know, I know we all beat ourselves up over things and it's hard not to,
right. To,
you know, to step into the new year feeling like I'm going to do this. I'm going to make this change, do this thing. And then there you are 9 days in. You're like, I didn't do it. I didn't make it.
I didn't do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. My whole year's over.
Right. Oh, well, I screwed up. I can't do it. That's a lot to you know, bear the rest of the year, really. And so,
yes. So
what do we do? I like the idea of creating a really specific plan, breaking mm-hmm. it down. What about, you know, sometimes there's advice out there about replacement behaviors. I think people hear this a lot about, well, I'll just say I know someone who's just recently quit smoking and she's replaced it with knitting. And so she's like, this is when I feel triggered, I'm going to do this. It helps me acknowledge that I feel triggered to smoke. But also replace it with something else. Is that a behavior that works pretty universally with goals, or is that specific to something like with your hands, like smoking?
It can work with a lot of goals. It's perfect for smoking because there is such an attachment to what your hands are doing, that motion, you know, of bringing the cigarette to your mouth. So it's perfect for that. The idea for a lot of people is, what behaviors are we going to stop and what behaviors are we going to start? And, attaching them to each other. So I'm going to stop smoking, but I'm going to start doing this. So it doesn't feel like I'm just giving up this part of my life, but instead I'm adding something productive and, you know, that feels good in place of that behavior that I'm stopping.
I like that a lot. That
yeah.
breaks it down a lot more and to just, okay, I'm never going to do this again, or I'm... You know, and I think, you know, that raises an interesting point, because I think sometimes when it's a goal that's about adding a behavior, it's easy to say, well, I didn't have time to work out today. So I think there's, okay, what am I going to stop doing so I do have time?
Exactly. So maybe you say, you know, I'm on social media a lot, which I think a lot of us are on more than we realize. So I'm going to be on social media 15 minutes plus a day and take that 15 minutes and get on an elliptical or a treadmill or whatever it is I'm going to do. And then in a couple of weeks, I'm going to add another 15 minutes to it so that I'm building on success versus, I think when we do that all or nothing, we end up trying to build on a failure.
Yeah.
Because we don't get it done at all. And then it's January 9th, forget it, I'm giving up.
Right. Oh, I hate that it's the 9th. I wish it was a little bit longer.
Let's change it to the 15th. Okay.
That feels like you stop short of jumping off a diving board. That sounds so gutting.
Exactly.
Another thing that we hear about a lot when we're talking about taking on something new, maybe starting a new challenge, something like that, is that yeah, but thing. I think that stops us in our mind, which I sometimes call beginner syndrome. I think we're all a little defensive of, you know, we want to have mastered something. It's hard to go in as a newcomer and say, I don't know anything about this, or I don't know any people here at this, I don't know, class or thing that I'm doing. How can you kind of psych yourself up to be in a good mindset for stepping into something with that beginner mindset?
I think this is a really, really important question. So the first thing is to be aware that it's going to feel like a failure the first few times, maybe even the first 20 times. So I coach people all the time around this. What's something that you've achieved in your life that you weren't really good at first? Which is, by the way, almost everything we've ever done.
Right.
So how did you get through it? You kept doing it day in and day out. You kept going back and going back, regardless of that really uncomfortable feeling that comes along when you're not good at something, especially going to a gym where other people see you, maybe a yoga studio where you're falling out of postures, things like that. Just having the awareness that it's not going to feel great at first and pushing through that, and really having almost a mantra that you say to yourself when you feel that discomfort to get you to step into that behavior, even though it doesn't feel good right now.
Right, right. I think, you know, the other night in my yoga class that I go to and love so much, there was a woman at the front desk kind of going, well, I'm kind of new to yoga. And she was asking some questions. And I walked to her and I said, you know what? We've all had a first day at yoga. Come sit by me. And if you've got questions, we can, you know, I'll help you during class.
That's so nice.
And she had a good experience. And, you know, I checked in with her a little bit after. And she said, I said, you know, how'd you feel about it? And I noticed the instructor was kind of checking in with her a little bit too. And she told me later she had gotten up at one point after she put her mat down, and she went and told the instructor, I'm just going to tell you, it's my first time doing this. And I just wanted you to know I'm not going to be as good at this as everybody else. And I just wanted to put that out there. And I really admired that she did that, because she kind of owned it and just said, I don't know what I'm doing. I want you to know that.
Right. And then there's then she really put her ego out of the room.
Yeah.
The yoga studio that I go to, they do something really smart that you can buy a mat on your first day, and you get like a week of classes if you buy the mat. And it's really smart because it gets people past that first time that feels yucky, so that they come a few more times. And by the end of the week, you're starting to feel just a little bit better. So then they want to keep coming.
Oh, that's a very smart idea. Then you're on the hook to keep going, because you have to get over that hump. Yeah, it is.
Exactly.
It helps you both, I think, physically over the hump, but you know, also get you out of that, like, oh, I'm not good at this. Because you'll start a week of yoga, you're going to start to feel something.
Exactly, exactly, because you've done it enough times. You at least get what the next position might look like and, you know, some of the basics around it. The first time you ever do yoga, it feels terrible.
Right.
You know, your body's all over the place and it's hot and uncomfortable and all those things, and you're embarrassed. So that the continuing to go and put your ego outside is huge.
Yeah, yeah. Well, a little bit later in the show, we're going to be talking with a yoga instructor about a body positive yoga program. So we're going to talk about that in more detail for sure. And so
Love it.
I want to shift a little though, and kind of back up a bit you said a phrase I really loved, and that was attached to your heart, to make sure that motivation is attached to your heart. I really like that.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're defining a goal and deciding what is success going to look like, what will success be here for this? It's really kind of like, how do you know your success point is a meaningful enough reason, that it's not something that's going to lead us down a bad path or make us feel, you know, how do we bring double down our self-awareness to our goals to make sure that it's the right motivation for them?
It's really asking ourselves to get conscious about why we're doing this. And in the business world, they have this Six Sigma thing where they ask like seven whys about, you know, why we keep choosing to make this move. The asking yourself why about a goal or a resolution you have is to dig down deep as, why actually am I doing this? Am I doing it because I'm ashamed of my body? Then your heart isn't attached to it, right? It's a shame based. Versus, I really love my body and I want to feel good every day, or I, you know, want to have energy to do the things that I want to do. When we dig down to that and we get it out of that superficial space and into that really kind of attached to ourselves almost, then we want to do it. It's not so hard anymore to do it because we're so attached to it. It's the things we accomplish, like, they flow because we want them so much, so badly. It's the things that we're not sure if we want, because there's so many mixed messages that we get stuck on and then we give them up.
Right, right. And I think that sounds like it would get us out of the dreaded shoulds of, you know,
yes,
someone expects me to do this, or I should do this at this age, or things like that, which never is motivating, ever.
Never. I should weigh less. I should look this way. You know, when I hear women say, you know, I should really be wearing the same size I wore in high school. Wow, there's no setup for a fall in that sentence at all.
Wow, wow.
Right?
Right. Says who? Gosh.
Right.
And so that brings me to my next question to you, and that is about motivation. And I suspect it has a lot to do with making sure that our why is really, that we've really peeled back all those layers and done some good soul searching. But at some point, I think there'll be peaks and valleys. And how do we get ourselves through that when it's like, oh, it's cold outside, I don't want to get out there and run, or I don't want to do this? And sometimes it's very easy to talk ourselves out of really good and healthy choices.
Oh, it's so easy. It's incredible. So whenever I'm working with someone, I say, so what's going to keep you from doing this? Mm. Let's set that up in advance. What's going to hold you back from doing it? And how will you be accountable for those times? Because it's easy to do when it's easy, right? It's a beautiful day out. My dog wants to go for a walk. It's super simple. Today it's 9 degrees. It's much harder. So when that, you know, really putting, looking consciously ahead at the things that get in our way allows us to make sure that we know how we're going to overcome those.
I love
it's not
that.
A surprise that it's 9 degrees in Chicago. Every year we get this weather, right?
Right.
So knowing in advance that we have a backup plan for those days, or we have a friend who's going to hold us accountable and we know that we're going to check in with that friend, or whatever that looks like of overcoming those obstacles that are absolutely going to show up, that we have a plan for all of those, we can't not make it, because we're going to know what to do when that situation comes up.
I love that one so much, because yes, it's going to be cold, it's going to be hot, it's going to be, there'll be extreme temperatures, yep. It's going to be rainy, we're going to have rotten days, we're going to think we're maybe catching a cold and should rest, and maybe we should, but maybe we're stretching it a little bit, right?
I think exactly.
Yeah, that's a great piece of advice, to plan in advance what we, like, pre-troubleshoot.
Yes, pre-troubleshoot. What's going to get in the way? What's gotten in the way of the task? Let's look at each of those. Like your friend with the knitting.
Yeah.
Most smokers try to quit about 13 times before they're successful. And how they end up being successful is that they watch for everything that they know could go wrong. And they have an answer for it.
That's very smart. That's really good advice. I've got to think through my own goals now and think about, okay, what am I, when I don't feel like working out or something like that?
Exactly.
How am I going to get my butt out the door? Well, wonderful to talk with you. Thank you so much, Lisa Kaplan. Everybody go to lisakaplan.com. Find out all about the awesome work that she does, empowering people, helping people do awesome, wonderful things. She is a psychologist and a life coach. Read all about her. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Amy. I appreciate it.
WGN. It's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us tonight. How could we not play that song? And by we, I mean esteemed producer Tom Hush playing all the songs tonight. We are talking all about health and wellness, body and mind. And so I could not wait to get our next guest on the program, and that is Amber Carnes, who is the creator, founder, woman behind Body Positive Yoga. If you are not familiar with the work she's doing, get ready to go find this website, because it is really, really important work. Amber, thanks so much for being with us. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. It's so nice to hear. I'm excited to be here.
Well, I just love the message on your website. And the minute I saw 7 days of subverting the patriarchy and speaking positively to yourself, I was like, okay, this is someone I want to talk to for sure. So tell us about body positive yoga and your philosophy behind it.
Yeah, definitely. So body positive yoga came about just through, I guess, the force of me coming to yoga about 15 years ago and not seeing anybody in the yoga studios that looks like me. So I've always been, since my teenage years, in a fat body and a bigger body. And I use the word fat, by the way, as a neutral descriptor with no stigma attached. I'll say I'm fat just like I say I have tattoos or dark hair or whatever. So just to let folks know that. But I never saw any people teaching yoga or really even practicing yoga that looked like me. And when I came to yoga, I really, I found such profound benefit from it, from the internal regulation tools that help to, you know, kind of quiet my mind and reduce stress. And also just the way that yoga helped me to get to know my body after, you know, probably more than a decade of disordered eating and not being very nice to the body that I was in. And so I really found such amazing benefits from yoga. I decided to become a teacher because I really didn't see folks who look like me represented. The yoga industry does a really, you know, in the West anyway, does a really good job of serving kind of one person. And, you know, if you think about wellness marketing, if you see yoga or massage or, you know, natural living type of stuff represented, it's usually one person, you know, thin, white, very young, able-bodied, usually wealthy, doing scorpion handstand on a mountaintop,
right?
Something like that, right? And so when we don't see, you know, and there's nothing wrong with Yoga Barbie, right? She deserves to move through the world in her body and be respected. But if she doesn't represent you, you know, if you're a person of color, if you're in a bigger body, if you're disabled, whatever the case may be, then that says some things to us about who wellness is for and how we are able to access or not access those spaces and those modalities. So I really believe that representation matters. And so I wanted to bring the concepts of body positivity and feminism and wellness for everybody. And so that's why I started doing what I'm doing, because I really believe that wellness is our birthright, no matter who we are or what type of body that we're in. So, yeah.
I'm sitting here nodding along as you're talking. I really love the message that you have behind your work. And you know what? Everybody, head to this website, bodypositiveyoga.com. I should have given that out at the top so you can see all the greatness for yourselves. But so there's a lot of messaging on there. One that really struck me was your body is not a problem to be solved, which felt like a relief the minute you read that sentence. It feels so good to hear that because it invites a shift. And you know what really struck me about the work that you're doing is that you are really fighting a very dominant narrative, you know, as you were just describing, of who wellness is for and why representation matters for lots of different kinds of bodies. And so how do you even begin inviting that shift through your yoga teaching and the programs that you do?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the really profound things about yoga and one of the reasons that it's been so transformative for people like me and, you know, the students that I work with is that it really is sort of set up as a perfect catalyst for body acceptance. Through yoga, you know, like I said, I got to know my body because when I first started practicing, I didn't have teachers that knew how to adapt the practice to work with me. So lots of times I would go to a class and I would be singled out or I would be struggling and the teacher wouldn't offer any help, or they would, you know, tell everyone else, like, it's time to do headstand. And I would have no way to do that. I'd literally be sitting in the corner with nothing offered. And so at first I had to really be creative about what my practice looked like, because sometimes my body just wasn't making the shapes that they were asking me to. And it really forced me to, sort of be really frank and like confront the body that I was in for the first time in a long time, because, you know, as a teenager and into my early 20s, I really didn't want to even acknowledge the fact that I had a body, because, you know, when you're in a body that's the opposite of what society says is good or worthy or beautiful, it can be really painful to like spend time, you know, really inhabiting that body. And so yoga actually, you know, is all about inner awareness and kind of forces you to be present in your body. And so I think that that tool for me, being able to just have the awareness of body, being able to connect with breath, and just kind of stay there for any length of time, was a really great way to sort of crack open that knowledge that, like, my physical body was a positive place that I could be. I could experience it in a positive way, rather than sort of this mentality of my body needing to be something to be fixed or to be solved, or kind of the constant focus on appearance, which is, you know, sort of the dominant narrative about what women's kind of role is, as, you know, someone to be beautiful or be, you know, perfect or whatever. And so not only did, you know, my body get stronger from the practice of yoga, but my mind really got stronger. And I see this with a lot of my students, too, that you know, the internal regulation tools that yoga offers, mindfulness and breath, and the skill of observing without judgment, allows us to create a pause, you know, so you can really start to do very simple exercises to observe, like, what's going on in your body, what's happening with your thoughts, what's going on with your breath. And when we learn the tools of mindfulness, which, like, my favorite definition of that is paying attention on purpose without judgment. So it's like the three parts: paying attention on purpose without judgment. And the without judgment is like the most important part. Because if we can start to build that skill on the yoga mat or on a meditation cushion or wherever, then we can learn to create that pause, the pause between, like, observing objectively what's going on and separating that from any kind of judgment or story. So, like, it's, you know, it's pretty difficult maybe to look in the mirror and see our body, and maybe our bodies are not what we think they should be or what society says is beautiful. And it's hard to look at that without judgment, right? Because we've been invited and trained to place ourselves somewhere in a hierarchy of worth or of beauty. But in yoga, when we can start to learn to observe something like the breath without judgment, that's a pretty neutral thing, right? The patriarchy so far has not made us feel some kind of way about the way we breathe.
Right.
So that's sort of a good neutral place to start. And then we can, like, start to build that skill, because these skills are, you know, it's just like a muscle. You have to get it stronger. We have to prove to ourselves that it is possible to do that thing. And so we get to practice on kind of a low stakes place before we take it out in the world and use those same skills to create a pause between, you know, the way we look and the judgment that comes there, or our relationships, or a difficult, you know, conversation that we have at work or something like that. Creating that pause really helps us to be able to respond from, like, our best self rather than, you know, those judgmental thoughts or, I guess, like, voices that pop up in our heads. And so that is really the place that I started to make the shift. And I think it's really kind of a magical little combination that yoga gives us, both the physical practice of really being present in our bodies and staying, and then the mental practice of being able to cultivate what we call in yoga the witness consciousness, which mm-hmm. is like being able to be that impartial observer of any given situation. And it's really, really powerful work. I mean, you can use the tools of yoga in many different ways, but for me, really the concept of non-attachment, which is something we work on a lot in yoga, that removing judgment, removing identity or story, it just really goes so well hand in hand with making peace with our bodies or eating disorder recovery or anything like that. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sitting here thinking of, as you're talking, I'm thinking of how much that yoga non-judgment and our self-talk features in. Even I think we're so conditioned to do it, sometimes we don't even realize we're doing it. I mean, you know, I just the other day in my own yoga class, there I was sitting there with a friend, and she was struggling with something, and she was like, "Oh, my stupid knee's just not going to let me do this." And you know, it was. You know, I don't think it was a major emotional announcement she was making, but nonetheless, there she was, like, you know, kind of damning this one body part, and telling, announcing and affirming, this is not going to happen. This is not, you know, my knee is stopping me from doing this, which is, you know, I think that self-talk is so, so fascinating, and what we're able to accomplish with a little more positive self-talk. And this is all really, really thought-provoking. We're talking right now with Amber Carnes, who is the creator of Body Positive Yoga. You can read about it at bodypositiveyoga.com. Amber, if you could stick with us a little bit longer, we got to take a quick break, but I have many more things to ask you if you'll stay with us a bit longer.
Sure thing.
Wonderful. Okay. We will be right back here in just a bit here on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us. We're talking all about health and wellness, body and mind tonight. Because you know what? A lot of this time of year, a lot of people making resolutions, and we kind of go off half-cocked, and we're like, yeah, I'm going to do all these things and climb these mountains and do all this and be da-da-da-da-da. And we make all these plans, and then we like drop them because we're not maybe clear on why we're making those changes. We're not clear on why we're doing the things we're doing. And we have gathered some really, really excellent people tonight to join us on the show to talk about this. And we're having a really lovely conversation with Amber Carnes, who is the creator of Body Positive Yoga. Head on over to bodypositiveyoga.com. Find out all about the work she's doing there. It's really, really lovely with some really, really beautiful messages of just how we talk to ourselves and how we think about our bodies and how we talk about our bodies and really what a difference that makes. And it's really, really a very, very thoughtful approach. Thanks for staying with us, Amber. I want to talk a little bit now about the business, because what you've essentially done is you've started a business that is counter to an entire industry, an entire system, a huge narrative. You know, you've really tackled a lot of things with your business and so thoughtfully, and so mindfully, but you have expanded, you teach, and location doesn't matter. You can take your classes from afar, but also you have events and products and all kind of things in this yoga empire that you've created. Tell us about that.
Sure. Yeah. So I work with people in a couple of different ways. My business, like you said, it's a hybrid of in person and online. So I do teach a lot of workshops all over the place, all over the U.S. and Canada right now, but hoping to expand that in the future. And then I also lead retreats. So I have three retreats for 2018, and so far, the past few years, those have all sold out. So they're really, really magical spaces where we create, you know, a really body affirming and non-judgmental space to explore movement and to talk about issues like, you know, body image and self-acceptance and things like that. And then I also have a lot of online offerings. So I have a monthly membership site called the Body Positive Clubhouse, where there's lots of us who are sort of on this journey of radical self-acceptance and using the tools of yoga and mindfulness to explore things like how we talk to ourselves and what our health and wellness looks like and how our self-image influences all the things that we do and the choices that we make. And so that's available through my website. I teach, I upload content every single month. So there's everything from yoga classes to sort of my real talk advice about different things that our members are dealing with. So I really create the content based on what they're working with. And I coach with these people to work on things like self-acceptance and how we move through the world in the bodies that we have today. And then I also have a lot of resources for teachers, yoga teachers specifically. I have an online course with another teacher from Canada named Diane Bondi, specifically for yoga teachers, because we really realize that most yoga teacher training programs don't actually educate yoga teachers to work with most people. We leave yoga teacher training kind of knowing how to teach other yoga teachers mm-hmm. who are, you know, very, like, strong and flexible, usually able-bodied, like, intermediate yoga practitioners, I would say. And so when somebody walks into a classroom who's in a bigger body, who's disabled, who's recovering from an injury, maybe someone who's older, we're less equipped to deal with that. And I think as a teacher, you know, not having those tools kind of, it's a scary moment to think, like, you don't want to hurt this person. You don't want to create an experience that's not affirming. But what ends up happening is they usually just get ignored or singled out. And it's really not a good experience for the student. So we created a resource that's sort of the little things that are missing from teacher training about how to work with people in diverse bodies, how to, you know, make sure that your yoga classroom and your wellness spaces are inclusive and equitable for folks that are marginalized by the fitness industry and the yoga industry specifically. So that's another big passion of mine is really addressing access to wellness spaces for marginalized folks. Because, you know, as we said before, like, wellness does a really good job of marketing to and serving, you know, one type of person. And it's no coincidence that that person really lines up with, like, the dominant beauty standard and that sort of identity. And so I think probably the cornerstone of my work, you know, is both radical self-acceptance, like, for the individual, but also making sure that wellness is accessible to everyone. As I said before, like, wellness is our birthright. And I really believe that you shouldn't have to be rich and white and young and thin and able-bodied to access that. Like, we all deserve that. We all deserve full humanity.
That's a really beautiful message. And so much of what you're doing is really for women and for creating a safe space for women. And it seems like these messages can be relatively universal, though.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I have folks of all genders that come to my workshops and my retreats and that are part of my online community. It tends to be women and femme folks that gravitate toward me just because that's who I am. That's my experience. And I can speak from that experience. And I also think that, you know, patriarchy hurts us all, even the ones who are in power. They just don't know it sometimes.
Right. Right. But
by and large, like, I think that the beauty standards that are upheld by that dominant narrative, you know, tend to affect women in a different sort of way than they affect men, or they affect folks that fall elsewhere on the gender spectrum. So that message that I have about, you know, sort of like living well in the body that you have and not postponing your life until you lose weight or look a certain way, like, really resonates with a lot of women. So
Truly. Well, because we opened the show tonight talking a little bit about New Year's resolutions, speak to the beginner listener right now. Maybe someone who's listening thinking, okay, this sounds good, but I'm still intimidated to start. How do I begin? What message would you have for that person listening?
Definitely. Like, I think, maybe two things. You know, one, if you're looking at yoga specifically and you want to start with yoga to kind of address some of those mind and body wellness issues, I would say start online. You know, I think there's a lot of people that are intimidated to go into a yoga studio because of the type of marketing that yoga studios use, because of that sort of dominant narrative about who yoga is for or who practices yoga or what it has to look like. So I think it's so important before you begin to really seek out images of people who are yoga practitioners that look like you. And so that might be someone in a bigger body. That might be someone who's transgender. That might be someone who's older or disabled. There are lots of us out there who are practicing and posting pictures and videos of our practice online. When I started, you know, there wasn't Instagram, there wasn't hashtags. I couldn't go find somebody that looked like me. And that's why I started making videos and putting pictures of myself out there, because I think representation is so important. So, like, find yourself a teacher online. You know, I definitely am, you know, one resource, but there's lots of different people out there. And try it in your own home. Like, experience some of that stuff if you're too intimidated to go to a studio. You definitely don't have to be in a studio to practice yoga.
Right.
So I would say, you know, start there. And then the other thing I would say is about, you know, resolutions specifically. I just did a whole sort of series on shame-free resolutions, because I feel like many times what happens is people set goals for themselves. And then, like you said, we find ourselves kind of 4 or 5 weeks in, like, giving up on it. Then we feel like a failure. Then we beat ourselves up. And I say, like, where are those goals coming from? You know, like, if the goals are someone else's definition of success or someone else's idea about who you are, who you should be, what you should look like, that's never going to stick, because the motivation isn't intrinsic, it's extrinsic. And so it's so important to really get in touch with who you are as a person, what's important to you, what's your why, what's your passion that drives you. And then really make goals that come from a positive and affirming place rather than a place of here's what needs to be fixed about you, because those are always going to stick better. I mean, there's plenty of scientific research around that, that people tend to stick with the goals that they set that come from an intrinsic motivating place instead of an extrinsic sort of rule or, story about who or what they should be. So.
Right. The should will always get you, right? When we think we
That's
should
right.
do something a certain way or look a certain way, or we should have certain goals, things like that, that'll always get us and always seem like a very difficult goal to attain because it's not, deeply in our hearts to do it. Well, such a pleasure talking with you. Everybody, Amber Carnes, go find out about her, bodypositiveyoga.com. Read all the things. Look at all of her offerings. Really, really interesting and thoughtfully done things there. Amber, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for taking time out of your Saturday. 720 WGN.
Hello, it's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us tonight. Always appreciate you sharing part of your Saturday evening with me. So tonight we're talking all about health and wellness, body and mind, because a lot of people are making New Year's resolutions right now, and we're trying to be our better selves and trying to do more or different things or quit doing something and do something healthier or better and something like that. We have lots of rules for ourselves this time of year. And so I thought we would gather together some really smart people to talk with us about that, about how we can put the odds in our favor a little bit better, because, you know, all that we hear about New Year's resolutions, it's true. It's really true that most of us make about 80% of us drop those resolutions by February, and only about 8% get to the finish line on them at all. So thought we would gather some really smart people with us tonight to talk all about how to put the odds in our favor a little more. And so we were just talking about yoga and self-talk and body positivity with our last guest, Amber Carnes. And so we're joined now by Dr. Judith Tedley Moskowitz, a professor of medical social sciences at Northwestern University. And her work is really around the impact of positive emotions on health-related and other life stresses. I think we can all relate with that about sometimes it's hard to manage our emotions when we're under a lot of stress. Welcome to the program. Are you with us?
Hi. Yeah. Right,
there you are. Okay, good. I have to turn your microphone on. Okay, so thank you so much for being with us tonight. And talk to us a little bit about that, because when we think of being under stress, positive emotion is not necessarily the first thing that we think of. We immediately think of gloomier emotions and it being kind of hard to keep a sunnier outlook.
That's right, yeah. So stress really does lead to negative emotions, sadness, anxiety, fear, and that's adaptive and normal. So I'm not saying that you shouldn't experience those emotions when stressful things are going on. But what we can also experience is positive emotions. And we've seen this in studies of people coping with some really significant types of life stress, that there are also moments of positive emotion and positive things that happen. And if we can notice those, they actually help you cope better with the stress.
And now is a really good time to think about that. Not only New Year's resolutions are on a lot of people's minds, and there's political stuff. Every day we look at headlines and that can be stressful on us. But also I think the holidays and winter can be very acutely stressful to people. Even without, health related stuff, I think that can be just a heavy burden on our mental health.
That's right. And the stress can get in the way. If you might have a whole list of New Year's resolutions that you want to accomplish, but if you're feeling stressed by, political events or the weather or the short days or the cold weather, that can get in the way of your best intentions for meeting those goals.
Right. And so where do you think most people fall on the positivity scale? Just kind of, I know there's such a wide variety of people, but generally in your work, are we, and there's a part two to this question, but I'm curious where you think where's our baseline generally?
I think, it really varies person to person. So, we all know people who are just unfailingly positive all the time, and then people who tend to lean toward the negative side a little bit more. But the fact is that everyone is a mix,
yeah.
Right? And there are things that you can do. So you might dispositionally be more positive or negative, but there are things that you can do to sort of nudge you one way or the other. to increase your positive emotions.
And so there's some work that you and your colleagues have done in this area of some specific strategies to kind of think through how to, I don't want to say summon, but kind of summon or try to conjure up a little more positive feelings in times of facing, big stresses in life.
That's right. Yeah. So, based on our studies where we were observing people experiencing really significant stress, like caregiving stress, we saw that they were able to experience positive emotions as well, and that these emotions were helped them cope better with their caregiving stress, for example. So, at that point, we started looking at, well, maybe there are things that people can do to bring about more positive emotion, because that is, to some extent, under your control. So we, based on our studies and based on some other work in the psychological literature, we put together this program of 8 skills or tools, things that people can practice and make a habit to have more frequent experiences of positive emotion, which then we think can help them cope better with stress.
And talk us through those, what those tools are, so that we can all try to put them in our toolboxes.
Sure, absolutely. So the first one, we have a package of 8. The first one is noticing positive events. The trick with this, when you're experiencing stress, is it's sometimes hard to see the good things that are going on, right? So you've got this bad thing going on, and it draws your focus there, which is adaptive, and humans have evolved to pay attention to the negative stuff so they can do something about it. So, we tend not to notice the good things that are going on as well. When we were studying caregivers, we were really coming at it with a focus of, what's stressful? What are you doing to cope with the stress? And we weren't asking about the positive things. And they actually asked to talk about the positive things. They're like, yes, you're right. This is stressful. This is horrible. But there are good things happening too. And they wanted to talk about it. So we started asking about those. And in almost every case, every interview, the participants could come up with something positive. So the skill here, or the activity you want to try is, sort of stepping back and looking for something good that might be going on. And it can be really small things. It doesn't have to be, I won the lottery. Like, that's a huge thing that's going to be really rare. But, a good cup of coffee, if you're a mm-hmm. coffee drinker, just enjoying that cup of coffee in the morning, or, the sun's out today, or, little things like that. And just taking a moment to notice that positive thing going on helps you access those positive emotions. The second skill is related to that, and it's called savoring or capitalizing, and it's sort of revisiting the positive things that have happened. So this is telling someone about something positive that happened. I think, this is what a lot of us do on social media, talk about good things that have happened, and it helps us get a hit of that positive emotion again. So, either telling someone about it or even just thinking about something good that happened. If you've just had a vacation over the holidays, take a moment and think, wow, that was really awesome when I was able to see my family, if that was a good thing for you. And that gives you an opportunity to re-experience the positive emotions. The third skill is related to those. It's gratitude. So this is, literally just taking a moment. Sometimes people do it in journal format, but thinking about something you're grateful for. So it can be, it can be something that happened that day, or, a positive event for you. Or it could just be, I'm grateful that I'm healthy, or I'm grateful that, I don't know why I keep going to the weather. I'm grateful that the sun was out today. Mm-hmm. Gratitude is the third skill. The fourth skill is mindfulness, like you were talking about in the previous segment. So this, paying attention on purpose without judgment. So we, in our program, we really focus on sort of the awareness and non-judgment pieces of it, where you're aware of what you're doing, your thoughts and your feelings and your experiences in this moment, and you're not sort of rehashing what happened in the past or rehearsing what you're going to be doing in the future. It's really just being in the moment.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but that one feels so important, but yet I think that one is so incredibly difficult. If you have, you know, a fight with your spouse or a bad day at work and you want to just sit there and I'm just going to fold laundry and be in the moment and just chill, but oh my gosh, you're rehashing it and getting mad. That one's really difficult.
It is. It's really challenging. And, a part of it is also non-judgment where, you know, you're experiencing what you're experiencing, but you don't judge yourself for it. You don't, you know, say, oh God, there I am ruminating on that fight I just had with my spouse again. It's no, you know, I'm going to focus on my breath just for a few minutes today and really try to be in the moment. And, you know, and there are, we teach this skill in one segment and do just sort of a mini mindfulness training. There are much more in-depth, you know, mindfulness-based stress reduction, where you can really go deep and learn mindfulness really on a different level. So, you know, we have a little bit, like I said, the sort of the awareness and non-judgment piece that we talk about. But if it's a skill that really works for you, there are more in-depth trainings where you can learn how to do it. Because it is, it's like you said, it is one of the harder things to learn.
Sure, sure. Okay, next on our list of these tools.
Next on our list is positive reappraisal. So, you know, an appraisal is your interpretation of the significance of something that's happening in your world. So the example that I always use is two people waiting for a bus, and the bus is late. And the first person is on her way to work, and if she is late for work, she's going to be fired. So the consequences of that bus being late are really significant for her, and she's going to feel a lot of stress. Her appraisal is going to be a stress appraisal, and she's going to have a lot of negative emotions. Another person waiting for that bus is just going to visit a friend. So the consequences for her being late aren't as significant. So she's going to have a less stressful appraisal of it. So your appraisals of what's going on in your world drive your emotions to a large extent. Now, a positive reappraisal is reinterpreting that event for in terms of how what it means for you. So a positive reappraisal of the bus being late is like, well, you know, I will, for the first person who is likely to be fired if she's late again, you know, she might say, well, you know what, this job is not for me, and there's probably a better one out there, and it's a good thing that I'm going to be moving on or something, you know. This is also, this can be a challenging skill for people, too, to reappraise things in a more positive way. But with practice, you can get much better at it. So we usually tell people to start small with this. So don't try to reappraise your rotten childhood, you know, as your first step. Like, you know, reappraise that you misplaced your keys, or reappraise that it's below zero outside. And, you know, by the way, the positive reappraisal of it's below zero is that then when it gets above freezing, we're going to feel like it's so warm, right?
Right, right.
Like, it really helps us appreciate when it gets warmer.
You know, what this brought to mind is I think we are, I think it's kind of a socialized cultural habit for us to quickly, when we're describing an event to somebody, for them to respond by quickly saying, oh, that's awesome, or oh, that sucks. I'm thinking of a particular event. You know, I ran into a friend and I said, oh, I got to run. I have to go to work. And the response was, oh, that sucks. And I was like, well, no, there's a really fun thing happening at work today. No, I'm really excited about going. And it stuck out to me because it was like, wow, what an interesting thing we are telling each other and ourselves that this is great, this is bad, and it seemed like what an interesting right. kind of pass/fail veneer we're putting on things.
Right, right. And the thing with positive reappraisal is it's you have to be careful doing it for other people, right? You know, I drive my kids crazy with this. Right. Well, you know, I'm sorry you didn't make that basketball team you wanted to make, but now you have more time to study math. Right. So, like, it's tricky, and you can get yourself into trouble offering people positive reappraisals. Oh, it's not so bad. And you're like, well, you know, actually, it feels really bad to me, and let me sit with that for a minute and then come up with my own positive reappraisal.
Right, right. I'm thinking right away of like kind of the rules of being supportive to people when they're grieving. You know, never should you say, well, maybe it was meant to be. Or you're like, no. Let that person have their grief. Right, yeah. Right. Let them have their grief. Yeah, that's a really important one, but very nuanced. Okay, what is next in our toolbox?
So we have three more. So the sixth skill is noticing your personal strengths. So this is when you're under stress, it can be very easy to sort of spiral down into everything that's wrong with you, mm-hmm. right? Oh, I'm terrible. And then, you know, the judgment again, I'm not coping with this well. The noticing personal strengths is, again, sort of just stopping for a moment and being like, but I have some good things about me. You know, I'm a good friend, or I'm dependable, or I'm funny, or, you know, just, again, you know, it's sort of a variant of the noticing positive events thing. It's noticing positive things about you. When we do this program, we have a version of it where we have facilitators teaching these skills, and by this point, the facilitator knows the person in the program pretty well because they've been together for several weeks, or, you know, have had several weekly visits. So sometimes if the people are like, there's nothing good about me, you know, and we work with people who are experiencing really significant stress, like, you know, being diagnosed with HIV. So, you know, they're 6 weeks in and they're like, you know what, I don't have any strengths. And the facilitator will say, well, wait now, you know, I've gotten to know you over the past few weeks. And they will then offer some things that they've noticed about them that are strengths. And there's always something, you know, you showed up today, right? So that's a strength right there. So helping people sort of notice, or, you know, if you're doing it on your own, just noticing the good things about you and focusing on that for a minute. The next goal then is attainable goals, which is very appropriate for a, when you're talking about New Year's resolutions. And, you know, this is based on research that shows that even making progress toward a goal, you don't have to achieve a goal, but making progress toward the goal can increase your positive emotion and give you sort of that hit of positive emotion. So we work with people to make those goals attainable, because that's the tricky part, right? So we work within this SMART goals framework. So, you know, the goal should be specific and measurable, and it should be achievable and relevant, meaning that it matters to you, and time bound. So instead of saying, I'm going to lose weight, you say, I'm going to lose 5 pounds in the next 30 days, you know, and so you've checked all those boxes. So that makes it a much more attainable goal, and you're more likely to stick with it. And then when you achieve it, then you get the positive emotion that then can help spur you to the next step. So if you really actually, you know, you want to lose 50 pounds, you start with 5. And then, you know, when you're successful with that, then you move to the next step. And it helps you keep engaged with the goal as well. Mm-hmm. And then the final skill is acts of kindness. So these first 7 have been all very sort of, you know, individually focused, internally focused. Acts of kindness is actually, you know, doing something nice for someone else. So engaging in some altruistic acts. My favorite study that supports this skill, they took some people in at the, you know, people off the street, brought them in, measured their levels of positive emotion or happiness, and then gave them all $20. And asked half of them to go spend that $20 on someone else and half of them to spend it on themselves. And then they called the people at the end of the day and measured their happiness again. And the people didn't know the second call was coming, measured their happiness again. And the people who spent the money on someone else were happier than the people who spent it on themselves. And it didn't matter how much their income was. Mm. So irrespective of how much they made, spending money on someone else made them happier than spending it on themselves. So, you know, that's just one finding. There's also a number of findings that people who volunteer more are happier and actually healthier. So just doing small acts of kindness for other people can help your positive emotion.
So interesting. That study is so interesting. You know, as these tools are also wonderful. And as I'm hearing them, I'm also thinking, I think there's a flip side of, or not a flip side, but like a dark side of this. And that I sometimes call it the positivity cult. Like the people that will be completely in denial of real things. Like maybe it's something like, a mental health issue. Maybe there is real, diagnosed depression there. Maybe it's just not being in touch with reality. Like, I think we see this sometimes with, affirmations, which I think are great, but sometimes, like, if you won't type up your resume, it's pretty unlikely you're going to get $1 million a year job. You know, I think sometimes there's, I think there's a little tension there, an inherent tension with that of you want to use tools and we want to be our best selves and we want to feel good and be kind to ourselves. And yet sometimes I think there is risk of not being realistic with ourselves. And I think that turns people off of positivity sometimes.
Yes, that is absolutely true. Sort of culturally, we, certainly in American culture, we sort of demand that people are happy and put on a happy face. And we sometimes call it, the tyranny of positive thinking.
Yes.
And it's such an important point. That is not what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about the ability to make space alongside the negative emotions and alongside the negative things that are happening. If you can, if you're depressed or if you've got some major stressor going on in your life, I'm not saying you should pretend that that's not happening or you should deny it or suppress your negative emotions. Negative emotions are functional. They're important. They motivate us. What this program does, though, is help you experience positive emotion alongside the negative. So you can, there's room for both. And if you can make space for the positive emotion, that positive emotion then sort of refuels you and helps you stay engaged in coping with whatever it is you need to cope with. So I guess what I'm really arguing for is sort of a balance and experience of both positive and negative emotions and not sort of just blindly relying on positive emotion or, positive thinking to get you through, right? It's more about allowing the experience of both positive and negative emotions. And I think these skills can help you increase the positive emotion, which is challenging when you're experiencing stress.
Truly. And I think you said two very, very important words. I think the alongside and coexist, like all of the language about existing with, and to me, that really fights this kind of moment I think we're in that seems very polarizing. You're either with this candidate or not. You're either feeling good or you're not. There are very few nuances in our language right now, I think, in our very quickly moving culture and communication. So I think this conversation is a really, really important one. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time, so I have to let you go. But thank you so much for being with us, everybody. Especially, there are many, many things. Scientific American, Thrive Global, lots of places where you can read her work. Go find it. It's great. If you follow me on Twitter, I will tweet it all out. Dr. Judith Telly Moskowitz, Professor of Medical Social Sciences at Northwestern University. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
720 WGN. Hello, it's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us tonight. Grateful to you for sharing part of your Saturday evening with me. So tonight we've been talking about body, mind, health and wellness, making this year real good, making it a great year, putting the odds in our favor. And we've been talking a lot about, we talked earlier about how to make really meaningful goals. We talked about self-talk and body positivity. We talked about positivity in general. And I want to shift now to more of that mind part, in particular, how we can grow and expand our knowledge and really nurture it with tools we have right here in our city. We're joined now by Amy Davis, who is the Public Learning Experiences Administrator at the Field Museum, which is a very cool title, if you ask me. Welcome to the program, Amy.
Thank you.
So talk to us. We have Museum Week coming up, and that's January 18th through 26th, where all the big museums here in town are going to be discounted, and we can go make the most of them and just wring all the knowledge out of them. And that is coming up, and it's a great thing that we do every year right here in Chicago. What will the Field Museum be doing during that time?
Sure. Yeah. The Field Museum will be offering $2 off of our basic admission. And then we also have a regular exhibit, the Science Hub, which is our interactive space. We have our early learning space, the play lab for the youngster to learn science. And then we have Ancient Mediterraneans, which is our temporary ticketed exhibit right now.
Tell us more about that one.
It explores the different cultures, the Etruscans, the Greeks, the Romans, and talks about how different cultures all come together in different ways, even though the history of them is so far apart on the map. You see trends that are similar across all of the different cultures.
Ooh, that sounds like such a great exhibit. You know, when I first moved to Chicago in 2001, the thing I wanted to go to the Field Museum almost right away, which I did, but it's, I mean, there's a lot going on there. There's, you know, you need, I kind of felt like I needed 2 or 3 days to kind of go through all of it. And I spent a day doing it. I still felt like I didn't even scratch the surface of all the things.
Yeah, it's incredible. The Field Museum, there's so much to see. And what a lot of people don't realize is there's 30 million specimens in the Field Museum's collection. And less than 1% of those pieces are out for the public to actually see when they come to visit the field. They actually have the other 99% behind the scenes in storage. Scientists use them regularly for different types of scientific discoveries, and periodically they come out in different ways. The scientists will bring them down for our Meet a Scientist program on Fridays. During Museum Week, we have Jim Holstein coming, who's one of our geologists, and he'll be bringing out some different rocks and minerals that glow under black lights and talking about what makes up rocks and minerals. And every single Friday from 11 to 1, we have a different scientist bringing different pieces from the collections, talking about how those collections are used for current research.
That sounds like a very cool event. So that's 11 to 1 on Fridays.
Every Friday, yes.
Every Friday. So spend your lunch break doing that, because that sounds like a very good time. And so, you know, this seems like a kind of a silly question, but a lot of times you're either like a museum person or you're a person who goes to please the spouse or the date or whatever. You're like, all right, I'll go to the museum. It's so quiet
sure.
right? But I think once you get there, especially at the Field Museum, once you get there, it's really, there's just so much. There's kind of a little of something for everybody. So what is there a right way? I mean, again, this sounds like a silly question, but is there a right way to get the most out of a museum experience?
That's a great question. I think it depends on what your interests are, especially a museum like the Field, where we've got anthropology, we've got geology, we have biology, zoology, botany. There's so much to see. And I think a lot of people need to be open to what they may not know they're interested in, but starting with what you're interested in, talking to the people that work there, everybody who works at the Field loves their job and loves talking about their favorite things in the Field Museum. And so that's a really great way to learn about some things that you maybe didn't know existed.
You know, I'm glad that you said that, because some of my favorite museum experiences have been when I've just asked the person standing there, like, what is that?
Yeah.
What's going on? I mean, that has been in art galleries and, you know, everywhere I've been, I try to go to a museum. And I remember there was a detail in a painting and I was like, what is that? Is that a frog? What's in that painting? And I ended up in this really long, interesting conversation about details that were hidden in this artist's work that was really fascinating, and why, and it had like political implications, and it was not the main thesis or the main narrative around this artist, but it was really interesting nonetheless.
Yeah, it's really amazing. And there's so many things at the Field Museum that have just really interesting stories behind them that just by stopping and talking to some people or talking to you, we have our volunteers on the main floor called the Discovery Squad. And what the Discovery Squad does is they take out these big activity carts that are filled with different hands-on things that people can touch. They're replicas, or some are actual real specimens from our collections. And they will tell some of these stories that people maybe don't realize about the Field Museum and the collections and the research. We have 5 different carts right now, and one talks about Wild Chicago, which is different animals that you might not know live here in Chicago and how that affects the environment and the ecosystem of Chicago. We have a cart that talks about, it's got 12 different animal skulls and how scientists can learn from studying those skulls. We have a cart called Hidden in the Collections, and that one specifically talks about just different discoveries that have been made using the Field Museum collections. For example, our anthropologists were able to study the resin on ancient pots and brew beer and actually taste the same beer of ancient cultures, which is really cool.
Oh, interesting.
And then I'm trying to remember all of our cards, but there's many of them. They're big and they're red and you can't miss them.
Right. They're big and red.
Yes.
See, stuff like that is really so interesting. And again, the field, there's so much going on there. I'm going to back up to one of those carts, though. You said the five animals you might not know are in Chicago.
I think it's five. I don't remember exactly, but yeah, there's different animals like that. We have river otters living here in Chicago, Massasauga snakes.
More excited about the otters than the snakes, but sure.
Yes, right, exactly. I think everybody's a little more excited about otters than snakes.
But snakes do their thing.
They do.
They're important to us.
They do, yeah. So I'm trying to remember what else is on the cart, but if you come to the Field Museum, you can check that out. Another really cool cart is our specimens cart, which talks about how we prepare specimens for study. And one of the things people find really interesting about that cart is we use flesh-eating beetles to... I shouldn't say we, the scientists at the Field Museum use flesh-eating beetles to, after they've skinned their specimens, to clean up them, the bones, so that they can then study their bones and their structure.
You know, you are the second person to say that on this program, because we've had, Rob Telfer from the Field Museum on the program talking about native plants to our area. And he described that same thing. And I had no idea until he said that about the beetles to help reveal bones that come in.
Yeah. It's amazing. One other thing that I think my favorite thing that they do, is with fish and reptiles, they do a process called clearing and staining, where they use a chemical called trypsin to clear the specimens, and then they use dyes to turn the cartilage blue and the bones red, and then they make these beautiful specimens, and they're able to see how these body structures work together without having to actually take them apart.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting. See, you have a very fun job. That sounds
very
like
interesting. I'm not doing justice to any of these processes as the scientists would, but
sure. Well, sure. Hey, that's okay. It's all very, very interesting, and you are speaking to a lot of different disciplines all at once. So, we are talking right now with Amy Davis, who is the Public Learning Experiences Administrator at the Field Museum, because we're talking all about how to make ourselves better in the year ahead, and that includes expanding our knowledge, using our brains. And with Museum Week is coming up, so Field Museum is part of that, January 18th through 26th. I'm going to stuff. You should go to stuff. That's what we do here. All right, we're going to take a little break. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us tonight. We have been talking about how to make 2018 a very, very fine year. We've been talking about positivity and self-talk and making really attainable goals and yoga and all kind of things, but we cannot overlook our minds and our knowledge. And so we have a visitor in studio with us. We have Amy Davis, who is the Public Learning Experiences Administrator, which is possibly the coolest job title I've ever heard. She's from the Field Museum, and she's here with us talking about all kind of cool stuff that's happening over at the field in time for Museum Week, January 18th through 26th. We should all be going to that, because that's when we get into museums with the big old discount and all kind of cool things are happening. So we should all take advantage of that. But we've been talking about the field in particular. And when we talk about the field, of course, we think of Sue, the T-Rex, who is the iconic figure. But she's shifting a little. And we have another dinosaur friend coming in. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so beginning in February, we will be taking Sue down and moving her upstairs to her own exhibit. And in place of Sue, we'll be installing a titanosaur. And titanosaur is it's 122 feet from head to snout. In comparison to Sue, Sue's about 40.5 feet longer than Sue.
Okay, that's a big dinosaur.
It is a very big
dinosaur. Is it like an upright creature like her, or is it more like a on all fours thing, like a
brontosaurus? It's more on an all fours.
Okay.
And so what's really neat, though, is because Sue is all a real dinosaur, and so you can't really get up close to Sue. You have to stand behind the railing. With the titanosaur, it'll be a cast, but what's neat about that is you'll be able to actually walk underneath the titanosaur. And it's so large that its head goes all the way up to the second floor.
Oh my gosh.
So you can look straight in the eyes to the titanosaur if you go up to the second floor.
Wow. That's going to be pretty cool to walk underneath the titanosaur and imagine like that creature in its lifetime.
It's a huge creature. We actually have a real titanosaur tibia in our science hub right now that visitors can come and touch the tibia and touch an actual titanosaur bone.
And how big is the tibia?
The tibia is quite large. I would say about 3.5-4 feet long.
That's a big tibia.
It's a big tibia, yes.
Wow. Yeah. All right, so that's happening in February.
That's happening in February, and the whole month of February is free to Illinois residents.
Great, even better. So yes. we can get in with a discount for Museum Week, but we can come back in February and it's free. That's very good and very fun. And then what other exhibits can we expect coming up in the months ahead in 2018?
On March 16th, we'll be opening our exhibit on mummies, which is a temporary exhibit. And that is really interesting because it talks about how we can use current technology to study mummies with X-rays and MRI machines and just the different processes of mummification, which is really interesting. And then we also, on June 15th, we'll be opening our Antarctic Dinosaurs. Which is really cool. It talks about how our scientists have gone to Antarctica to dig for dinosaurs and what that expedition is like and what they have found in Antarctica.
Coldness, I'm guessing.
Definitely.
Frozen bones is what I'm guessing.
Definitely.
I want to back up to the mummies exhibit a little bit, because when we think of mummies, we immediately go Egypt.
Sure, sure.
But I'm guessing this is a little more encompassing of different areas.
Yeah, what's really neat is in the Field Museum collections, we also have Peruvian mummies.
Mm.
And so the process of mummification, from what I understand, is also something that happened in South America, as well as the Egyptian mummies. And so I believe the exhibit talks about that, but I actually don't know too much about that exhibit.
We'll have to wait and see. So that's March 16th.
Yes, March 16th.
And then our very cold Antarctica dinosaurs are happening in June 15th.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay, so that's very fun. And then what other cool things can we expect from the museum this year?
Well, we have our science hub, and what's really great about the science hub is it's our hands-on science space where we always have educators in the space and sometimes scientists as well, allowing visitors to touch things and go through different activities where they can learn about the process that scientists do. So right now, until the end of January, I think January 25th is the deinstall, they would learn how scientists even know where to look for dinosaur bones, when they get there, the process they go through. They get to touch some actual field jackets and dinosaur bones while they're in there and learn how do scientists dig for dinosaur bones. On the other side of that exhibit, we're talking about how scientists study insects, focusing particularly on beetles and ants, and how do we study things that are so tiny. What's really cool about the Science Hub is that each exhibit stays for 6 months, but on a split schedule. So every 3 months, there's a brand new exhibit in the Science Hub and new content for the educators to be talking about.
That sounds so fun and so cool. Again, you have such a cool job. What a cool job that you have.
I like it.
So we have a caller, and so I want to check in real quick. Hello, caller. You're on WGN Radio.
Hi, good evening. I'm wondering, I know that you used to do a wonderful educator's night, and Indiana teachers were always free. And I'm just wondering if you are gracious enough to also include the Indiana teachers in your free admittance.
That's a great idea. It's not something that I particularly work on, but I would recommend emailing the Field Museum, probably our school programs or our ticketing on our website. You can find that information.
Okay, because as you know, Northwest Indiana, we're your neighbors.
That's right.
And I know that, you know, we've certainly taken advantage of, you know, of your offerings before. So, all right, I appreciate it. And your program is wonderful. And as a host, wonderful question.
Oh, thank you so much. What age group are you teaching?
Kindergarten.
Oh, little ones. Oh, that would be so fun.
And they absolutely love science. I'm so excited about STEM and STEAM and all the activities that science has finally come around with that, you know, that really excites kids.
That's so great.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for the call. Right. Have a
thank
great night.
Thank you so much. Right, you bye-bye. Too. Bye-bye.
What a great question. So hopefully she'll get her answer.
For sure.
Great. And so, well, she brings up a good point, though. What about coming to the museum with little ones?
Yeah, we have our play lab for ages 2 to 6. And that space, it's an interactive space where families can play together. By reservation, field trips can go into that space. And it's a nice place for kids and parents to learn and get their hands on science together.